Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride, and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory faint, the breeze.
Chicago, Cook County journalist, a real journalist. He covers a lot of stories. I don't always agree with him, but I've known him for many years. Generally honest, and of course, it's a wonder that he hasn't run for public office, but that's another issue we'll deal with another day. Anyway, Patrick, we missed St. Patrick's Day yesterday, your feast day, and of course you're being part Russian. There's some interesting births today and assassinations, and of course Lavrenti Beria, the guy who thought he was going to succeed Stalin, he was born today, and but they took care of him after Stalin's death. Patrick, there's a lot of things happening. As I told you off air, some planes landed at O'Hare that came from Japan, and they claim there's low-level radiation. How do people feel about you have the Dresden plant, which has been online, I think, for about 50 years, down in southern Illinois or central Illinois. How do people feel about this nuclear situation that's everybody around the world is concerned about?
People are getting a little edgy. I mean, I'm not saying there's a panic, and I'm not saying there's hysteria or anything like that, but I've talked to several people just since yesterday, and they're a little apprehensive about this because, let's face it, nuclear energy can be pretty tricky, and, you know, we know that there's stuff. Well, look, a mutual friend of ours died of Leo Saban,
right.
Died of Agent Orange. Agent Orange was one of these things that was supposed to be benign to the people that were using it, and it was supposed to be dangerous only to the plants that they were trying to defoliate. And now we're finding, of course, that Agent Orange hurt as many Americans probably as it did of the enemy. We don't know diddly squat about all of the properties of nuclear energy, and a lot of people are afraid, and a lot of people want answers very quickly. What happened in Japan, just as what happened in Chernobyl, should be a wake-up call to the entire world. It's not an American issue, it's not a Japanese issue, it's a human race issue. We need to know these things.
Right, Pat. Well, it's interesting because the Japanese have a particular interest in it, since they're the only country where two atom bombs, although they're not as part, those bombs that were dropped, Fat Boy and the other one that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, weren't as powerful as the weapons that are being developed and have been developed today.
Well, that's
and
right.
There's a fear that Gaddafi may have these weapons. Iran, I get confused with the Middle East ever since the British left, But I don't know. And then, of course, there's the earthquake thing. Now, are you familiar with the Great Madrid Fault? That there was
the Madrid Fault of 1811, which would have gone down in history as one of the major earthquakes, except for the fact that there weren't that many people in Illinois, Missouri, and Indiana to feel it when it happened. Chances are that an infant Abraham Lincoln probably was awakened when the ground shook, because certainly where he was living at the time would have been impacted by the Madrid Fault. What we often forget here in Illinois, because we normally think of earthquakes as something that happens elsewhere, like in Japan or in China or in California, I might add, we forget that Illinois also has a few faults and a few sleeping earthquakes that wake up every now and then. And, you know, when they wake up, they are felt. The last time was a little almost 200 years ago, but, yes, it could happen again.
Now, of course, you won't have to worry about a tsunami from Lake Michigan. Along that line, Patrick, are you familiar with the allegation that after World War II, with all the atomic material, the nuclear material from Tennessee, Oak Ridge, I think, that people didn't worry about it at the time, but the some of this material was sent to Hanford, Washington. There was some supposedly buried along the lakefront in Chicago and, mm-hmm. and cemented over. And then here in San Francisco, a hill where there's a housing project and three streams underneath it. They built an affordable housing project, and there's supposed to be nuclear waste buried there and elsewhere up at in Marin County. Are you familiar with any of these allegations?
Well, I've heard stories that, you know, God knows what happened in and around the University of Chicago. Because,
oh, right.
You know,
where the first,
that's where they first split the atom. And
right.
That's where they did a number of early nuclear experiments. And, of course, in those days, they, number one, didn't know what the properties of this were, and, number two, were more prone to feeling they could get away with, you know, hiding things, and no one would ever raise the question, because, after all, that was during the war, and the mentality was good citizens didn't ask questions like that during wartime.
Or if they did, they were silenced.
Well, they were made to see the error of their ways.
And, you know, great way with euphemism, Patrick. You would explain away Noah and the Ark.
Well, I think I once told you that, you know, Custer blew a great opportunity, because he was certainly in a very target-rich environment on June 25th, 1876.
Well, he was a damn fool. He thought he would have all the glory, and he got it in a different way for eternity. I think he's in hell. A lot of people probably think he's in hell.
Hey, we got a couple presidents that they'd be forgotten today if they were not assassinated.
Yeah. Well, incidentally, talking about birthdays, John Calhoun, who was Andrew Jackson's vice president, wasn't he
right.
The one that said, "I'd rather be right than president," or was it Henry Clay?
Calhoun's the one that said he'd rather be right than president.
And then, of course, get this, a lot of the public...
And he was neither.
Well, interesting order. As part of our new series is oratory, and we've been playing excerpts from great orators. We don't have that. I think you would agree with me that we have a lot of polemics today, but not oratory.
No, we don't. We don't have for example, someone of the oratorical quality of William Jennings Bryan, who here in Chicago made his memorable Cross of Gold speech.
Oh, yes.
You
know, it's
not
interesting.
You shall crucify mankind upon this cross of gold. You shall not press this crown of thorns upon the brow of labor.
Well, they seem to feel that in Wisconsin and elsewhere since we went along that line. But it's interesting that I was just going through my history thing, and, for instance, Grover Cleveland, that was his second name. His first name was Stephen. And then the notorious Neville Chamberlain, I think his first name was Arthur. And, of course, Woodrow Wilson, his first name was Thomas.
Right.
So it's quite interesting that these people don't use their first name. Of course, along biblical lines, my favorite president was Harding. As you should be aware, that the middle name Gamaliel was made up by his mother because she wanted something to sound biblical. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Now,
and he looked and he looked almost biblical too. I mean, Harding was one of the few people that we've had who actually looked like a president. The problem is he wasn't a very good one, but
he didn't practice, and like our theme at the end, politics and poker, instead of smoke-filled rooms and poker and a few other things, some nice women, we have probably Chardonnay and cocaine these days. I actually have seen it at our city hall, a little snort of the white powder.
Yeah, Chardonnay has kind of fallen from favor. The people
it's a little
who
expensive.
Are really living high off the hog tend to prefer Lafitte Rothschild.
Oh, my God.
I can give you the years that are best, but Lafitte Rothschild is more in vogue now.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Since you brought up Rothschild, you know that the French Rothschild, during World War II, they didn't send him to the camps. They put him in a castle, I understand, a gilded castle. Have you ever heard that?
Well, I understand there were a couple of Rothschilds who were sent to the camps, but these were not very influential Rothschilds.
Ah, I see. Shirt-tail relatives, probably.
Just like, you got shirt-tail relatives of all kinds of famous people and all kinds of titled people, and the shirt-tailed relatives, don't necessarily get the gilded cage when they get arrested.
In more ways than one.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, a relative of the King of Italy, definitely a member of the House of Savoy, was arrested and put into camps and died in the camps.
Yeah, Mussolini should have been put in one, but he was putting other people in.
I believe the King of Italy came under some fire because I believe he was either married to a Jewish woman or had a Jewish mistress.
That wouldn't surprise me. Of course, there was a lot of intermarriage and, of course, I call a Jewish heritage, because I don't even know if these guys practice or if they met the brisk at their birth.
Yeah, well, some, as a matter of fact, had continued to practice, and this was true in Spain as well, had continued to practice Judaism while they were nominally Christian.
The Moriscos. Yeah. Maybe in my family. Incidentally, since we're talking about kings, this is interesting since it ties in with the Prince William, who's going to be married to Commoner, Kate.
Right.
She'll be another Catherine. It seems that name is jinx, it seems to me, for the British. But George the First, get this. When Greece was occupied by the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, but around 1900, they invited a Danish prince who was related to my favorite English queen, the consort of Edward VII, who's my favorite English king. He knew how to live. He had great choice in women and high living. Unfortunately, he didn't live long enough. But anyway, George I was Danish, and he was invited when he was 17 or 18 to be king of Greece. He was the second longest was the longest reigning Greek monarch, 50 years, and he was assassinated today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But one of his sons was the father of Philip, who is the great grandfather of Prince William, who's going to be married in a couple of weeks.
That's
so it's quite
right.
interesting. All these relationships, I guess, what we call a royal incest.
And for a time when Philip was growing up, you know, just because they had a title in front of their name, did not mean they had money. The family was really scrounging, and very often had to get the leftovers and cast-offs from some of their better-off royal brethren.
Well, he married well.
Yeah, he married well, but see, one of the reasons they got him that appointment to the Naval Academy was because that would be a good way for him to be able to earn a living.
Oh, yes, right, yeah, Portsmouth, I think.
Because
also,
the family
here's a guy who lived high, yeah, here's a guy who lived high thanks to the British, Farouk. He died today. I didn't know he was 45, but all of his profligate living, and of course, since Egypt's been in the news, maybe they need a monarch, or what would it be, a caliph?
No, a caliph was the head of a branch of Islam. He was the closest thing the Muslims ever had to a pope. The caliph was the religious leader, and that would be worth a whole different program. But no, Farouk was the king, and Farouk's the royal lineage stems back to Armenia, where he came from a family of camel herders, and you know, they were brought there by the Ottomans and installed as Ottoman puppets. Late 19th century, when the British started moving into Egypt and the Sudan, the Ottoman Empire maintained nominal control over Egypt and the Sudan, but in reality, they were semi-independent as long as they paid lip service to the British, who by that time were practical rulers of Egypt. But Farouk is no more Egyptian than you or I are.
No, maybe my dog.
He did, however, have a very nice exile where he would practically every night go out to nightclubs with several thousand dollars in his wallet, and kind of paint the town green.
Well, I think he was deposed, wasn't he, by
Nasser? Legend has it, well, it was a military coup.
Right.
And,
that's not unusual in that part of the world.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, Nasser was not involved in that part of the coup, but he was at that time one of the junior officers involved in the coup. And then he kind of elbowed his way into the presidency. Legend has it that Farouk, when Farouk was arrested by the army and told he was no longer king, was sitting on the pot reading comic books.
Which reminds me of a music, a great composer, German composer, who said was reading a critic's review of his work, and he was penning a letter, and he said, "I'm in the smallest room of my house. Your review is before me. Shortly it'll be behind me." Gotta have humor with these guys. His music,
yes, you do.
Well, it reminds me of eating sauerkraut, but that's another story. Now, some other interesting things, since this is a day late for the Irish, although some of the Irish I know are still celebrating. Prince William.
Or recovering.
Recovering. They never recover, you know that. William of Nassau, of the House of Orange, fascinating guy. Of course, the tie-in with European politics and the troubles in Ireland, I guess is what you call it, the troubles. There were two assassination attempts. One was successful. One was, but William of Orange, apparently, he started as a Lutheran, became a Catholic, and then reverted to Protestantism, Calvinism, married several times, and then there was a successful assassination by a guy named Gaspar. And the Dutch decided to give this guy a horrible execution. They ordered his hand to be burned off because he shot William of Nassau. And I think one of William's sons or relatives went over to Ireland about that time. Are you familiar with the House of Orange?
Yeah. The William of Orange you're talking about was the father of William of Orange, who was the nominal commander of the Protestant forces at the Battle of the Boyne. Interestingly enough, those Protestant forces were being backed by the Pope, who wanted to undermine the position of James II. The Pope need not have worried because James II, who was in nominal command of a handful of British troops and Irish troops, fled the field, leaving the Irish earls to try to rally the troops. And by that time, it was a total. It was unfortunately through no fault of the Irish troops or their leaders. It was a total panic, and that led to what was known as the flight of the wild geese. You've heard the expression wild goose chase.
Right.
The wild
right.
geese were the Irish lords who, after the Battle of the Boyne, fled to Europe, mostly to France, some to Germany, some to Russia. And as a matter of fact, many of those became mercenaries. Well, they didn't use that term, but they were for hire as officers in the Prussian army and in the Russian army. So some of the top Russian officers were actually of Irish descent. There was, during World War II, a German general, the equivalent of a brigadier general. I mean, he was a general, but he was not much of a general. By the name of Heinrich von Butler, B-U-T-T-L-E.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Who was descended from the Butlers of Ormond.
Mm-hmm.
And there were also Russian officers in service of the Tsars as late as the Revolution of 1918 who were descended from Irish lords. Patrick McMahon, the president of France after the fall of Napoleon III in 1871, has a strange name for a French general or a French president. He was descended from Irish lords who fled some years later, fled after the revolution or the upheaval of 1798. So,
yeah, that. Go ahead, Ben. I'm sorry.
So, the Irish have provided talent in many fields to many countries throughout the world, not just the United States, not just Australia or Canada or New Zealand or whatever. As a recent president of Ireland told me during an interview a couple years back, quote, "Pat, we are everywhere." And she said it with the most gleeful expression because she realized that there was, they call it the Irish diaspora. You know, the Jews, of course, talk about their diaspora.
Oh, you guys are supposed to be the 13th tribe of Israel, according to some.
That's correct. That's correct. There are
Cohen and Cohan.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, some words in Hebrew and some words in Gaelic are very, very similar and have similar meanings. So I don't know how far I'd want to, you know, draw that analogy, but the fact of the matter is that, there are some surprising things about, the Irish that, people don't realize. One of which it is a very international group of people who keep turning up in the damnedest places. The first admiral of the Argentine Navy was an Irishman.
Oh, yeah, they still have. Of course, even recently, the Chilean, there was a guy in Irish name, descent, when he was with General Pinochet, who had a German middle name.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there was also a guy by the name of Bernardo O'Higgins.
Right.
Bernardo O'Higgins was one of Simon Bolivar's top generals.
Right. Yeah, that Irish streak is quite still there.
Yeah. I mean, we as a group will go anywhere where there are opportunities. And at that time in Latin America, with the upheavals that were going on as the Spanish Empire was breaking up, you had, new countries being born, such as the Confederation of New Granada, and Bernardo O'Higgins was one of the top generals who made that development possible.
We got to take a break here and play a theme It's very dear to the Irish and a great Irish name. Stay.
Grab a a spear or a sword or whatever they could find, and the ones that were not as well funded would grab a club or whatever and just go charging into the enemy. The rebel yell, made famous during the Civil War, actually originated with Celtic warriors who would go into battle shrieking like banshees.
Mm.
And,
now,
it did two things. It, number one, pumped up the people that were going into battle, and number two, it scared the hell out of the enemy who saw these naked men coming with spears and swords and figured they're crazy enough to do anything and usually ran.
Now, when the Spanish Armada, the survivors of the ships, sailed around the north of England and shipwrecked on some of the shores of Ireland, I understand the English hunted down the Spanish, stripped them, and then killed them. Was there any significance to that, or is this just so they were?
That was just the English behaving like Englishmen.
Well, we both read the book. I'm still reading The Fatal Shore. And how the English treated the Irish, transporting them 6 months to Australia. And when they got them there, all this flogging and that. But not only that, there were some interesting terms like shirtlifters. Have you ever heard that?
Oh, I haven't heard that. But
well, that's homosexual rape. Well, anyway, some of the Irish...
Which went on in any prison situation. And
oh, it's much worse with this.
And went on the ships of the Royal Navy as well as other navies.
Well, that was supposed to be a hanging offense, but a different type of hanging. anyway, the one Irish kid was talking to his priest, and he said, such things are not known in Ireland. And apparently the English, sodomy was more... associated with them than with the Irish. Of course, that later changed, I understand, having been to Australia. quite a big gay contingent over there.
Mm-hmm.
Crotch politics, as I call it. Now, one part of the Irish we haven't discussed is their violence. And now, I don't know if you're familiar with this. This judge, very famous, Isabella Horton Grant, Grant Horton. Her uncle was Edward Everett Horton, who was the fop in the Fred Astaire movies with Ginger Rogers. Now, Fred Astaire's older sister, Adele, left the act. They started as children, practically. She married an English lord named Lord Cavendish. He was the grandson of Lord Cavendish, who was the peace emissary, I think, from Gladstone, who went to Ireland to try to broker peace, like... that Swedish diplomat went to Palestine, and both were assassinated.
Right,
now, one of the assassins was with this group, the Invincibles, was Patrick Helenan, the grandfather of the former and corrupt district attorney here in San Francisco. He fled to San Francisco, he wasn't extradited, and he became a trolley driver. And then his son was Vincent Hallinan, famous lawyer with the Longshoremen, that corrupt union. And then he had five sons. Three of them were lawyers. One of them was a lawyer for the Marcos, Ferdinand Marcos's buddy, Dr. Malibet, whose case I had to investigate. But what is it about the Irish and this type of violence?
Well, before I answer that, I will mention, I'll add as a footnote to what you just said about the Cavendishes. One of the Cavendishes... of that Lord Cavendish strain, married a woman from Boston, Massachusetts, Kathleen Kennedy. Now, Kathleen Kennedy was a sister, long deceased, but she was a sister of John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
So
I forgot about that.
The Kennedys were at one point... Their in-laws included the Grand Master of the Masonic movement in England and its colonies, because Lord Cavendish at that time was Grand Master of the Masons.
Mm, I didn't know that. Oh.
Yeah, and Cavendish was killed in a battle in Europe during World War II, and Kathleen Kennedy was killed in a plane crash.
Right, I understand that was not a marriage sanctioned by the church.
It was not a marriage sanctioned by the church, and it was not more importantly to the Kennedys, it was not a marriage sanctioned by Joe Kennedy either. He was not particularly happy about that. Because remember, in those days, and before we get into the business of the violence, in those days, the Irish in this country and many other countries had to be very defensive and had to kind of stick together. You talk about the Irish being clannish. There was a reason for that, because in a lot of places, they were persecuted because of their nationality and because of their religion. So,
right. Oh, yeah.
The idea of
sticking
with your own kind was a survival mechanism. I mean, today they don't do that anymore because, quite frankly, as a police sergeant told me once, they'll never persecute the Irish in this country like they did in the 1840s because this time we got the guns.
and you know how to use them. And they have. Both ends.
Yeah. Now, as far as violence is concerned, I mean, I know the Irish have a reputation for being, you know, drinkers and brawlers and violent people and all of that sort of thing. The fact of the matter is, I can point out as many philosophers and priests as I can, you know, professional military people or boxers or what have you. The circumstances of that country's tragic history for 800 years made violence a rather necessary thing. When people come into your country and take everything that belongs to you and tell you you've got to adopt a new religion, and then when you start raising objections, they start carting you off between 1642 and 1652, 100,000 Irish were killed, mostly by Oliver Cromwell's troops in Ireland. Not all of them in battle. During that same period, 300,000 Irish were bought and sold and deported as slaves to the West Indies. They were sending more slaves to the West Indies than they were sending black slaves at that time.
Mm.
It gets better, if you will, when they found a lot of women and children who were homeless because their husbands had been sold into slavery. Some of the English planters in the Caribbean bought the women and children as well and had them breed with black slaves.
Oh, that's where we get the light skin.
That's where you get the light.
Like Colin Powell.
So when you run into blacks who say they're half Irish or part Irish or whatever, that's probably correct because they had Irish ancestors.
Was that where the term? Go ahead.
The term what?
Black baked Irish comes from?
Not really. That comes from a later, you know, a later period. But the fact of the matter is, you know, the Irish were sold into slavery, just like the blacks were. The only difference was it did not pass from generation to generation. You might be a slave, but your children wouldn't necessarily be slaves. With blacks, however, if you were a slave, your kids were slaves and their kids were slaves and all of that kind of stuff. But so the Irish have the kind of a history that you can hardly blame people in that situation from getting violent. But, you know, history shows no greater number of atrocities committed by Irish rebels than any other group of people. As a matter of fact, there were far more atrocities committed by the British than by the Irish themselves. The Irish would simply kill the guy. The British would find better ways of making them suffer.
Oh, yes, flogging. It's incredible. 100 lashes, and then a week later more, and then he wouldn't even let them.
They did this even with their own people. They had in the British Navy, when they wanted to sentence a guy to death, although not really sentence him to death, they had what was known as whipping around the fleet.
Oh, right, right.
And
right,
they
now,
would take the guy on one ship, give him 20 lashes, pour salt brine on his wounds so he began to, you know, recover. Then maybe about a week later, they would whip him again, 20 of the king's best, on the person's backside, and then keep doing it until maybe the person might have had, within the space of a month or two, 150 to 200 lashes. What would generally happen is infections would set in and it would kill them if they didn't die of pain while they were being whipped.
Yeah, I understand.
Eventually, I don't know how much you know about, you know, flogging, but
too much.
Eventually it peels away the skin to the point where there's nothing there but raw meat.
Oh, yes, horrible.
Yeah,
well,
and
I understand
then infection sets in.
Yeah, the what was it, the mutiny in the Royal Navy at Battle of the Nore, I think it was, there was one of those cases. And then Captain Bligh allegedly, when one of these sailors, which was lashed to like a big board or whatever they call it, and the guy with the whip went down into the boat to lash him, he said, "Captain, he's dead." Well, he says, "Lash him again anyway."
There are two sets of stories about Captain Bligh, one of which was that he was, you know, an over-the-top sadist, another that his behavior was no different than that of any British sea captain at that time. The Royal Navy was not a nice place to be in. In fact, sometimes condemned people would be given the choice of going through with the hanging or being sent to the Royal Navy. And some of them thought it would be easier just to take the hanging.
Were any of the Irish victims of the press gangs?
Oh, yes. Yes, they went after everybody. They were equal opportunity. They'd go in a bar. They'd do it two ways. They'd go in a bar and just look for guys who looked physically capable of being fairly good sailors. And so they'd either get them drunk and then take them to the ship, or they wouldn't even do that. They'd just hit them on the head and then carry them off to the ship. And then tell them the following morning when they're all lined up on deck for inspection, "You have been compulsorily enlisted into His Majesty's Navy for the duration." Now the army was a little more humane about it. What would happen is there they'd recruit out of the taverns also, and a sergeant in full dress uniform would come in maybe with another man, and he'd walk up to somebody that looked like he might be a fairly likely prospect, and he'd order him a beer, and he would put a shilling in the beer. When you drank the beer down to that shilling, you belonged to His Majesty. You could, if you were not totally drunk by that time, you know, you could say, "No thanks, Sarge, I've had enough." But most of these guys, you know, drank themselves silly, you know, in the absence of cable TV and all of that kind of thing, they had to have something to do. And so they repaired to the pubs, got drunk. And that was how both the Army and the Navy got their recruits.
Well,
but as a matter of fact, the Americans weren't much different. Do you know where the United States Marine Corps was formed?
No, tell me, in a bar.
In a tavern.
Oh.
Well, what they did was they put out handbills throughout the city of Philadelphia, announcing that a new Marine unit was being formed for the United States, and well-disposed men are invited to, you know, basically see what the Marines have to offer. And so they came there, and they, you know, gave them free beer and grog and whatever else. And no, they didn't hit anybody on the head. The Marines have always been a volunteer organization. They really have. So, you know, you were given this nice green uniform and, you know, a fairly decent pay for that time. And actually, you had authority over the sailors on the ship because you were also the police force.
Oh, right. And so did the they had Royal Marines on the British ships as well.
Yeah, yeah. And so also did they have on U.S. ships, because the Marines were also the policemen of the fleet.
Right.
And
now, on this day, bring back a little history, which ties into the Irish. President Cardenas, Mexico, one of the dictators in 1938, nationalized the British and the American oil companies. Mm-hmm. Few people know that Bill Buckley's father was one of those oil buccaneers down there. I don't know if he descended from the Irish who were went down there in the Mexican War. Pat, can you fill us in on that chapter of history?
Okay, you're talking about the San Patricio Battalion?
Right.
Okay. During the Mexican War, the U.S. Army, as they had done in other wars, recruited troops straight off the docks. When you would get off the boat, there would be recruiters there, and they would basically offer you a job, 3 square meals a day, a brand new suit of clothes, and the authority to carry a gun and all of that kind of thing, you know, which looked good to somebody just getting off the boat. And what they didn't realize was that in the 1840s, there was a great deal of discrimination against Irish, particularly Irish Catholics. And, for example, in later years, of course, there was no prejudice or anything like that, but in those days, Irish Catholics were discouraged from trying to become officers. And, you know, Irish Protestants who had been here for several generations, that was not a problem. As a matter of fact, that's where most of the officers came from. But Irish Catholics just off the boat in the Mexican War, that was discouraged because, remember, you had thousands of people getting off the boats. Most of them were illiterate. Most of them were ragged, diseased, you name it. And they were not a welcome group of people at that time. They went into the U.S. Army, you know, and were treated incredibly bad. When they went down to Mexico, the Mexicans were very friendly to the Irish soldiers because the Irish soldiers were Catholics. And Mexico decided to try to get some of these troops to defect. They did. They defected and went into their own branch of the Mexican Army, the St. Patrick's Battalion. And this was actually an artillery unit which fought very well in a couple engagements. The promise was that they would have Mexican citizenship and free land after the war, and for those who wished and could qualify, commissions in the Mexican Army. And unfortunately, most of them were captured at a battle shortly before the fall of Mexico City. The ringleaders were hanged. The ringleaders were put on a gallows where they could see the flag on Chapultepec Castle in Mexico City. The castle still stands today. I've been through there, and I've literally been through the halls of Montezuma. And so anyway, they were kept, you know, unblindfolded until the Mexican flag came down and the American flag came up. And as soon as the American flag hit the top, the American sergeant in charge of the execution dropped his handkerchief and the trapdoor fell and these guys died. Legend has it that they were singing one of the Irish rebel songs as they plunged down. Today in Mexico, on the anniversary of the execution of the San Patricios, they have a special ceremony outside Mexico City. And they usually they held the president of Mexico and the Irish ambassador there. And they still remember them today. The San Patricios who were not hanged were literally branded as traitors. They had a T branded into their forehead. Now, in the United States, that was equivalent to the mark of Cain. In Mexico, it was a mark of distinction.
Weren't they there in the movie? One of the guys was flogged several times.
Oh, and in the movie One Man's Hero, that was pretty accurate, incidentally. Mm-hmm. But remember, in those days, they flogged freely, not just in the Army or the Navy. I mean, they would flog you for not saluting an officer or whatever. That was done very freely. And as a matter of fact, flogging was only abolished in the U.S. Navy in 1871.
Yeah, I think the British Navy was the last one to abolish flogging. As Churchill said, sodomy in the lash.
That's the
British Navy.
Yeah, well, I don't know if, you know, how much sodomy still continues in the Royal Navy, you know, but officially, anyway, the lash ended in fairly modern times.
Hmm. And yet, since we're in modern times, Patrick, what's the economic situation? Are the labor unions in Illinois supporting the what we call civil unrest, labor unrest in Wisconsin?
I don't know how much unrest you would call it. Yes, labor unions are supporting the demonstrations at the Wisconsin State Capitol, because what's happening is, they're not ticked off because of the fact that the unionized state workers are being asked to make concessions. Virtually all unions have made concessions in the past couple of years. That's necessary for everyone's survival. They are up in arms because of the fact that the workers there are being asked to give up their bargaining rights as a union. Now, it's one thing to sit down with union representatives and ask the union representatives to agree to X number of furlough days and perhaps, you know, a 5% or 10% cut in pay. That's happening across the board. But when you start saying the unions cannot act as bargaining agents, that cuts to the heart of the union's very right to exist. And whether it's teachers, whether it's police, whether it's firemen, whether it's newspaper reporters, the fact of the matter is you've got to have, you know, bargaining rights in order to function as a union. So, yeah, the unions throughout the country are very much up in arms, and they did send lots and lots of demonstrators to Madison, Wisconsin, and it apparently is having an impact.
Well, you know, we got a governor of Massachusetts, Calvin Coolidge, who made the statement, public employees have no right to strike. And what happens?
Well, actually, I think
Boston police strike.
What that out was when the Boston police went on strike.
Mm-hmm.
And it might have been something else if the librarians had gone on strike. But when you have the police department go on strike or the fire department go on strike, it cuts to the very heart of public safety. And so, I mean, that's just one step away from the Army going on strike.
Well, there was. Now, when I worked for the government, one of the things was you've got a guaranteed pension and all that, which, incidentally, on this day, the government started the payment of pensions to government employees. I think it was back in 1818. And the rule was you had no right to strike. Now, that seems to have changed. There was a mail post office strike back in 1970, I think it was. I think that's one of the issues, that if you work in the public sector, that you're guaranteed certain pensions, hospitalization, medical care, which is becoming exorbitant, you give up. You don't have the right to strike as compared to somebody, say, a steel worker, a coal miner, Teamster, whatever.
Right. But see, and I'm not going to, you know, try to negotiate labor law here, but the fact of the matter is that what was at issue here in Wisconsin was not the right to strike, but the right to bargain. And that's a whole different thing.
Okay.
You know, the jury is still out on whether public employees in certain areas like police and fire have the right to strike. What ought not to be at issue, but is becoming an issue, is whether or not they have the right to bargain.
We got a few minutes left. Patrick, now it used to be that the Irish were in the forefront of the American labor movement. You had, CIO?
John L. Lewis,
coal miners, and then, of course, you had Samuel Gompers, who was English-Jewish, with the AFL-CIO. Do you still see Irish, descendants of Irish immigrants prominent in the American Union movement?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I see it in the Newspaper Guild, and I see it in the union that my son-in-law is involved in, and he is a building engineer, and he's active in the union, and has his family has a lot of friends who are higher up the ladder in the union, and most of them are Irish American.
Okay, well, I don't use the hyphenation because there's been so much miscegenation. You know what I mean? I think I'll remember that line. I just spun it off the top of my head. Patrick, thank you so much for being on, and let's do another show. People like you, and you got a great radio, you have a great radio voice, and you didn't try to con us too much this time.
Well, thank you, I think.
And by the way, you can tell everybody that this stays up in the archives at Blog Talk Radio, The New Shadow, Amicus Veritas. I'll try to get this all to you because I've got 2 years of interviews and stuff and radio programs plus the video at Amicus Veritas. By the way, since you have Russian descent, one of the great composers, in fact, there were two classical composers who were naval officers. One, Rimsky-Korsakov, was born today. And I'm going to be putting up, we had the Russian ship, the Vareg, which is the name of a famous Russian ship that was, the keel was laid down in Philadelphia. It fought in the Russo-Japanese War, and then its namesake came to San Francisco in June. And it's an interesting case where the only habeas corpus involving a foreign military person, reached the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm going to get into that because I researched it by accident. It's a fascinating story, and we'll get into that another time. And it will be up, but the Vareg is up on my Amicus Veritas YouTube site. It's got about 5,000 hits, and we play, I don't know if you saw that, Patrick, we play the old Russian Imperial Anthem. People love it.
Oh, yes.
And you were right. Thank you for bringing it to my
attention. Do you know that the tune is the same as We Shall Overcome?
Right, you brought that to my attention, and having a music background, I should have remembered that. It might be in a different key, though. Yeah, well, it's great. People loved it, and they said, where'd you get that? And I said, it's the old Russian Imperial Anthem, and we got more of the same.
Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact,
Deutschland über alles was actually written by Haydn back in the 17th.
Was an Austrian.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Austrian, the Austrian Imperial Anthem, right up until 1918, was the same tune as Deutschland über alles,
right,
the German Imperial Anthem.
Right, yeah. Of course, what my German friend said, we were Nazis, they still are. We got to run. Do it again. Thank you for being on the show, and happy St. Patrick's Day. Now you can go out and finish your goodness.
My pleasure. Have a good one. Thank you.
Good night, Patrick.
Okay.
Say, Ben, want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you going to do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
likewise
impulse.
Possible straight, possible flush, nothing. Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How about we should make Jack Riley the guy?
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
Well, I'll be another Irishman. So this is Peter Paul Brazzola. We started early today because of a switch. We'll resume at our usual time at 5:30 on Monday, and then on Wednesday the same time, and then on Friday it's an hour. So thank you for listening. This stays up on the archives, and go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site. This is Peter Paul Brazzola. Good night.